concerned with the fact that this character that I was going to play was a totally indictable man. And I said that I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do that. I said, what would you do? I said, I would do Nick's part, but it's already Kaz. And I said that the best thing for us to do, since we're friends, is to continue to try to make it difficult for the character to do what he does. And so that it comes out as we have to rather than we do. There was a line I threw in at the end, I swear to you, I don't know where it's gone, but it was there in intent, and I believe that the producer, director, etc., all thought, and this is not really just patting myself on the back, they thought that if I played the part, that it would probably be more sympathetic than somebody else. And you have to know that actors are not the most confident people, regardless, right? And we always want some kind of backup, you know. So if you remember in the point of the movie where we're firing him at the gym, one of the last words said to him by me is, take the deal, or I guarantee you will never teach again for the rest of your life. And my last line in it was, I can't help you anymore, Alex. You see? But I believe that it was a redundant statement because they wanted it to read simply in the character. You know? Yeah. So that's I'm really saying that what I wanted to do was a redundant action, and I think they were smart by not doing it.
So you soften this guy up again, from the script to the
ending. Yeah.
At what point did they assure you that you could do that, and that you believed them?
Well, right from the beginning, because as you know, when you do movies, you're in a constant state of flux, as you know, because you can do a scene at a time, and if you got your mind on the end of the movie, you want to make sure that it happens early on, you know. No, I don't mind being unsympathetic. I mean, of course, if it calls for it, yes. I've played unsympathetic people. I'm surprised that I play sympathetic people. Used to be asked only to play the other guys.
Well, you're trying to stay
with. I mean, I played a trashy, miserable, rotten gypsy one time. You know, I mean, that was a totally forgettable movie. But the reason they wanted me was because I was most likely. It's who I really am, you know. When I leave, I just pick up the table and dump it on you. You'll see.
was this film... Do you feel more secure about this film than The Goodbye Table?
Secure?
You said that actors not being the most confident people.
The Goodbye People is interesting because I, when first offered the part, it was in the play. It was in one production of the play, not the original production. I remember going up to audition for it a long, long time ago in one particular production and wanting to play a different part, and nobody would have ever expected me to play that part that you saw. So I was auditioning for the part of the husband who gets jilted in it, right? And it was new. It was just put in. Elaine May was directing it, and she had me read all the parts, including the old man. And it was like one of those wonderful auditions, you know, in which I was wrong for everything. Then Herb Gardner wanted me to do the play later on after he saw me in a play called Chapter 2, and I didn't know him. And he wanted me to do it in Los Angeles with Herschel Bernardi. And I said, but I'm wrong for this. You understand, I'm wrong for this. I'll shortchange the play if I'm in it. He said, why? I said, well, there's a certain amount of ineffectuality about that guy. And I was wrong, but I didn't know it. The next part came a few years later, about 5 or 6 years later, in which I found myself in the movie. We were auditioning the girls for the part, right? And I was auditioning them as well as the director and the producer. And one time after one of the girls left, I said, wasn't I wrong for this part? What am I doing here? I'm already a partner in the production. Herb looked at me and he said, you're not wrong for this part. And then I realized that his mind, it wasn't that he changed, it was he always wanted the guy to be a man who could instead of a man who couldn't, but a man who was looking for how to do it, you know. So I always saw the guy as a kind of a nebbishy guy. Can't quit his job, you know. Mr. Softy, and he's afraid of life.
It sounds as if, I mean, this play's been haunting you for about 7-8 years.
Yeah. He said a wonderful thing. He said, think of him as a sculptor, because he's a sculptor. And think of him, I said, well, do you mean he really wants to sculpt statues in the park, those monstrous big things in metal and bronze? And what? He said, exactly. I said, well, who is that? He said, me. Because that's who he was. He wanted to be a sculptor. Herb and I are very similar. So, didn't take long.
What is it that you look for in a role when you're reading a script? Do you look for the sensitivity or the subject matter of the movie? Because you're very picky about the movies you're in, as far as you're not in
I think there's a number of things that happen at the time you take a movie. For instance, if you've played too much of one thing, you certainly don't want to do that. And you want, and the good old term of stretching is, you know, available to me to say, but it really is the thing that you wanted to play, and other things might be present in this. You know, if you do, remember, a part doesn't give you that tremendous leeway to play all those wonderful things. You have to play this person, but this person is like a lead up to another one. And I really look at the movie. I never really look at the part, because I'm, you know, otherwise I would be only this standoff person who would only accept lead parts or anything and do them for money. Well, I looked at the entire movie and very closely followed the story on how it goes from the beginning to end, and what was the process that I was supposed to maintain in the movie. In other words, the is he a prime mover, or is he just sort of a person that hangs around? Is he a person that has an effect? Okay, you don't want to play anybody with no effect. At least I don't. And how true it all is, because I think if there were the major difficulties in whether it was true or not, I think that would be a major difficulty in mine being in it. So he had his one about truth.
The character in the whole story, in other words.
The character, of course, yeah. No, but does it all work? Does it really work? Are we telling some flamboyant fibs here? Are we telling some... If you want to do a total satire, well, then you do Saturday Night Live. You know, that's okay. But you accept that from the very beginning. The premise is we are going to be outrageous. You know, we're going to do Airplane or Airport, whatever the name of that picture was. Where all the reporters run into the phone booth and the phone booth falls down. You know, those are truly funny things. I would do that tomorrow afternoon, but this is not the case. I was just afraid that he was a totally indictable character. And I was pushing for the idea that he's a true old-time, long-time buddy of Nick Nolte's. So I took that as the point of departure, and then there was a part in the picture which really got me. Now everybody has their own history, right? I used to watch films when I was a kid, and I loved the ones about Santa Claus and about Jesus Christ and about anything wonderfully.
Sometimes together in the same.
Yeah,
film.
I thought they were the same guy. And there was a character in this played by Richard Mulligan, a slightly, psychotic person, perhaps, who seems to be dropped from heaven, like an angel, into a morass of stupidity, you know, of ineffectuality. There's a whole school of people who can't teach because of events that are going on, and because the school is in such a terrible state. And here's this guy who's not even a teacher, drops in here, is close to being a maniac, and who's teaching these kids better than anybody.
Mm-hmm. him as my teacher looking good.
So I took, in my mind, I looked at him as the one of the lead elements in the picture, and we spent most of our time talking about that character, even though I wasn't going to play him. That was our meeting, our first meeting. I was doing what you're doing. I sat down at a table and I said, who do you think this guy is? We all went around. And we all found out that we were talking about the same thing. This angel whose element, when he leaves, is totally serious, right? And he says, shakes hands with Nick Nolte. And Nick says, Mr. Van Ark. And he says, Gower.
And that is a prolonged scene, too.
Yes. Needs to be. Needs to be. Otherwise, you would turn it into what you were talking before, perhaps the joke, perhaps that unreal thing, or the satire, you know? He all of a sudden was welded into a real person. He said, the best line in the entire movie, I think, one of the most leading lines in the entire movie, when they're leading him out of the building, the white guys in the white coats, he says, take your hands off me. Don't you know do you know who you're talking to? And they said, yeah, General Custer. He said, I'm a teacher. So the kind of dignity that a psychotic had was indicative of the dignity that we were expecting all of them to have. Interesting. True, true. I did. I wanted to play that role.
There was only one actor who said, I forget what role he wanted to play, but everyone else came in and they said, well, that's the role I wanted to play.
Well, the other parts were taken.
As it is, your character and Nolte's are two kinds of characters that we're seeing more of now. The 60s activists who have maybe sold out in some ways, or they become strategic. We're trying to work within a system and maybe burning out as a result. There seems to be that kind of role now.
Good.
Prevalent.
That's good, good. Because there's a little piece of history that passed by too quickly. You know? The same feeling that people had when the Beatles broke up was the feeling they had when the 60s was over. Especially the peace movement. We lost a great deal in this country when we, however we did this, disenchanted that group at a time when they didn't have to become older yet, you know, when they weren't going to take on the responsibilities of their own particular lives. We were very close to a government that had more to do with the voice of the people, because we had the largest crowd of a single group in the history of the country. Never happened before. You know what I'm saying? That age group was the largest percentage of the population, of any group of population. I forget what it is, 16 to 24. And so we lost something. And I think that that going back and picking up the roots now is just like digging up the best writers that we had who are always writing about things like that, you know, and always writing their own stuff. Paddy, if he didn't die, we would be looking for the next wonderful movie by Paddy, because it's totally written. And we would have Chayefsky movies, you know. And this we don't support that kind of thing in this country. The Broadway scene is... You should excuse the expression, fucking dead, because they don't support they don't go for the writers who have made it what it was. Tennessee Williams died. Arthur Miller's not writing a hell of a lot, you know.
Norton's gone.
Inge is dead. Whoever these people are, we never do their... Huh?
So I said you can always bring in stuff from London. I mean, I was in London last year, and now everything that I saw in London is playing in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
By contrast, the student body in this high school, notably absent, are causes... parades of anything, draft resistance, anything. There's no identity that we see that these students seem to have.
You mean this?
In teachers.
Yeah. Oh, interesting, because lumped together, remember, you have to take a point of view when you do a movie, so you could take the point of view of the kids' stories if you wanted to, and then you'd have a new episode called Students, right? And it would be an interesting picture, probably more satiric than this, because remember, you're looking through the eyes of teenagers who are walking satires. That's what they do. That's their business. Their trade is to be satiric, challenge authority. That what we were trying to do is to make them this glob of total innocence. We didn't want to cry over their situation. We wanted to show the effect on them as being so totally unfair. You know, there were enough shots. I was so glad in this movie. There were enough shots of these kids, so that the classes had their feeling. All the classes were different. Remember that wonderful idea somebody came up with. I don't know how they did this, but let's see. The teacher, who is it? Royal Dano, has a class that sits with their backs to the teacher, set up by him. And the only thing they do is pass the papers forward, do their work. He never says a word. This was called discipline.
I never figure out how he achieved that.
Yeah.
Marvelous. Just wonderful. Just a wonderful idea. I came into the class one time because I saw the set, and I liked Royal. You know, we were good friends. And I came and I saw it before he started to shoot, and I said, well, where they put the desk? And they said, what's in the right place? I said, when do they turn the chairs around? They said, no, not in this one. Riot. Wonderful idea. And not wrong. And it actually is true. They do that. Some sit them in circles, some sit them in line, some stand, some do demonstration.
Do you think it's feasible for them to be so quiet while he's sleeping behind the newspaper?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh. ridiculous, famous, maniacal high school you could go to. It was all boys. There were a number of very famous graduates who I don't want to mention. And it was a public school. It was in New York. We had about 3,000 students. It was overcrowded. And I thought that I was... part of a child army when I was there, you know. It was us against them. We did things like raids on other schools. Remember the famous panty raid idea? Well, we did it. And beat up people, you know. There was a grand teacher's strike. This was a very famous teacher's strike in New York, in which the students were more excited about the idea that the teachers were going on strike than the teachers were. So it became ridiculous. It was a march. The students marched on City Hall during the teacher strike, what seemed to be in support of the teachers. But they were having a grand old time. We were charged by horses. I mean, if you plant an idea of a certain kind of freedom in a school like that, you're going to get chaos. Until you plumb what they're really about. They're not about chaos. They're about some kind of order. But you're talking about teenagers. So, we've never found a system to teach teenagers. Just as people were never trained to be parents, teenagers were never trained to be themselves. There's no development bottom line idea about teenagers. They're all different. And I think what's going to happen in the country is that they're going to have certain schools develop in little pockets to deal with that whole teenage time.
I think you would make a good teacher. I'm serious.
It's rather recent because I have a kid who is a teenager and he goes to a very special school to treat that particular time of life, you know. And he's becoming this wonderful, extraordinary, talented human being. And I'm watching.
How old?
18.
And what kind of school is it? You said it's a special school.
The school was broken away from another school. In other words, the administrator broke away from another school in which his hands were tied about being able to treat teenage problems. In other words, it's called it deals with the emotional difficulties of teenage more than it deals with academics. So that all the teachers are in therapy, all the kids are in therapy, all the administrators are in therapy, and it sounds like an over-therapeutic school, but it isn't. And it's very much based on the autonomy of the dormitories. In other words, it's a place where you can say and do almost anything in the dormitories. All right? And it's practically illegal to tell anybody what you've done or said. So everybody has a chance to confess their entire life, all the time. Amazing.
Take a course in radiator repair. That kind of practicality you just don't find that often.
I remember those radiators in school when we were kids, how they'd bang, clank, and when it was kids, you know, would say, don't touch that thing, it'd blow up. I wanted it to blow up more than it really, it never did in the scene, but.
And at the same time, the young lady was learning the tools.
Yes, absolutely. You give me the wrong tool, of course. Yeah, they learn early, don't they, you know?
Have there been any teachers in your own past that maybe you've adopted as a role model or?
Not really, but I grew up in Ames, Iowa, you know, when I was real young, and my grandmother was the head of the Memorial Union at Iowa State College for 30 years, and my mother's sister is a teacher in Corvallis at Oregon, and as a little kid, they used to put me in little suits, and I'd have to go down in this big, huge, building scared the hell out of me.
Building like this one.
Yeah, except those big pillars at universities and scared the hell out of me, so I didn't open a book. I went the other direction, you know. But that's... So I grew up around teachers, and then out in Agora, you know, where I had a place, the man that owned back of me was a school teacher in the L.A. school system, and I helped him build his house. And he's left this... the school institution over an arbitrary ruling and is very upset with the kind of structure it is. And so I consulted with him a lot and showed him the script, and he laughed a lot. So he said, oh, God, that's it's worse. He'd say.
You just got from one film where it's basically a two-character film. to an ensemble piece.
Yeah.
What are the differences in terms of how you visualize the material?
Well, you know, ensemble piece is really difficult to do, and you know, and Arthur's done a marvelous job because it really is, you know, that this whole the story's the thing, and in a two character thing, you know, you're there every day, and this kind of thing. So, it was fun, you know, and it worked very smooth. You know, as you're going along, whether the play is working or not, and it's I just saw the film the other day down in West Virginia, you know, and Teachers, yeah, down there, and I had it flown in and saw it with my father-in-law, who's a vascular surgeon, a retired vascular surgeon. He said, "It's great. Just imagine what you could do if you were sober." Well, that's a doctor, you know. Yeah. I say, I keep telling him, I'm worried I'm going to play a doctor story, but they're all gay. And he says, no, don't mess with doctor. This is my wife, Becky, over here.
Was it a thrill to work with Hepburn?
Mm. Oh, yes. Yeah, she's fun. She's been doing, you know, she's been an extremist all her life. You know, that's how she phrases it. I tried to call her a natural, and she said, "Oh no, I'm an extremist." No, she's fun. You know.
How do you feel about schools? What are your feelings about?
Well, you know, one of the reasons that I was interested in the material is you know, I grew up in the '60s, which is an old, tired story. We've all heard about it, but. What the changes that were made in the school institution in the '60s don't necessarily apply today. Those kind of things that were changed then really are not necessary now. And you know, we used the school institutions as political forums, and we opened up those doors in the '60s, and they'd never have come back out. You know, really, you know, if you want to test a law on school on prayer. You go through the school institutions. One of the stepping stones of a political career is to get on the school board. And, you know, school board, and then you go on the city council and that kind of thing. So it really, I think it's up to the teachers to, you know, I mean, there's no reason that the police should be in the school institutions. I mean, teachers can police their own schools. They can discipline. They've always were very good at it when I grew up. You know, we always got in a lot of trouble. It wasn't a cop that got us. It was the teacher, and we got whacked, you know, or whatever. And that's just been all taken out of their hands. So when you get a bureaucracy like that going, it's very difficult. And I think that's what we were playing with there, and I think that's what, you know, I think that change is coming about, too.
Well, there's a telling scene where at least one parent in the picture, a set of parents, comes under indictment.
Yes.
Because of Macchio's problems.
Yeah.
Is this also something that you would pinpoint as a problem now in today's schools?
Well, yes, but and that also deals with the lawyers. I mean, you know, justice is justice is kind of out of whack. And that's what law school is all about and lawyers are about. They're kind of into economics right now and not law. So you're getting real oblique and obscure lawsuits. Doctors are being sued for saving somebody's life. Actors are getting sued for crazy palimony suits. You know, you just... and there's too many rich lawyers. And, you know, and that can seep right into the educational system, you know. You know, where you're getting sued for millions of dollars because kid can't read, you know. But that's a lawyer problem. Injustice for All dealt a little bit with that, but, there again, they incriminated the judges, too. I think the judges are fine. I think they're making wise decisions, but it depends on what they're presented in the docket, what they can, you know. And
Well, that was the point of Star Chamber, too.
Yes, right. It was Frank's thing, but I think, you know, I had read that and knew that piece well. You have to end that right. You know, I don't know what the ending of that film is.
Do you love acting as much as you did, say, 10, 15 years ago?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Quality of the love for a change?
When it ceases to be fun or I run out of stories, then I'll leave it. But right now I'm still quite caught up.
What do you look for in a script when someone presents you? You're obviously a hot property now and you're getting several scripts.
Well, I started out kind of oblique, so my experience has always been material that I either picked from novels or instigated or, you know, North Dallas 40. I actually got it done through a journalist. I just came back and announced I was doing, told Army Archer I was doing North Dallas 40. Well, I didn't own the rights. It had been a buried project for 7 years, and Army Archer announced it, and I got a writer friend of my own. We wrote for 6 months, and just by accident, Bob Rafelson had called me and said, "Are you serious about it?" And he said, "I think I can take a run at it through the old Snyder estate." And all these guys took all the rights and jammed them into Paramount because they didn't want Rafelson to take a run at it. And that's how it got done. And that's the same thing with Dog Soldiers. So I don't... Teachers came to me as an outside script. That's very rare that you find a piece of material that's presented to me. Presented that way. I don't know why it's been that way, but that's the way.
Because all of your roles seem so unorthodox. You have outmoded ideas for the society you're living in.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of my, it's kind of what I, you know, I'm getting a little tired of my own theme. Sure. If you look at teachers very well, you can see a similar structure to North Dallas 40. I mean, it's I maybe shouldn't be talking about this, but we, you know, there's an Inquisition. In North Dallas 40, you had an Inquisition. See, a lot of that is a design. Same, similar.
You say you were getting tired of your...
It's good drama, you know, to have somebody under a problem, a previous problem, and then he has to go through, learn it, and he makes an adjustment. That's a good theme, good for drama, and it's good for life and all that. But I'd like to start out with maybe everything is fine. Go the other way, let it all fall apart, and then it all get back together or whatever.
Was this role a challenge for you, and is that very...
Yeah, it was every role is a challenge, and this was a challenge because I didn't know how to do it. So I had to make it up as we went, and it's always, that's the fun part. You know, acting is really making it up, so there's no real, it's not something you teach, you know, it's something you just kind of discover.
A transition in terms of your performance.
Can you speak up, please?
You know, but I don't have to pull out a 45 and blow somebody away all the time, you know.
Did you lose a lot of weight for this role?
In Teachers? A little bit. You know, I had come off of the Katharine Hepburn film, which I'm much thinner there. You know, I just varied the weight depending on the character. In North Dallas 40, I was 48 hours, I was 230 pounds, you know. You know, Walter and I said to Walter, I said, what should we do with this character? How should he look? And Walter's got a little belly, you know, and wears cowboy boots. He said, well, he should look like us, don't you think? I said, great. Yeah, listen, you know, so I just put the cowboy boots on and talk like Walter, you know.
In some of the sequences, you seemed very hoarse. Not just hoarse, but very hoarse.
Yeah, I was real tired. And we looped that, but you know, your original track is it bothers me too a couple of times. That's because I did two films, they were almost back to back, going from New York 1 month off and then straight into Teachers. And I might have let that tiredness get out of
Get you and Gary Busey together.
Well, Gary's my buddy.
Is that ever going to happen?
Oh, sure. I know. I hang around Gary a lot. In fact, when we were doing Quigley, Gary came into New York pre-production on Bear, you know. So he was holding all his press out of the same room that we were doing pre-production in. And so over in that corner, you'd have Gary doing press. And over here, we had the table of Quigley about killing Katharine Hepburn. And, the press over there was trying to go, listen, one thing, talking about, you know, Gary's going, yeah, well, my buddy's over here. And, you know. So Gary and I just live a few blocks apart, so we get together a lot.
How did you like working with Ralph Macchio?
Ah, fine. The way Ralph was portrayed in the film is kind of the way I was a student when I went to high school.
Loner,
and, you know, it was into other things, you know. You know, didn't go A, B, C by the rules, you know. You know, just going by the rules may be fine for, you know, building a circuit board, but, you know, to design the circuit board, you need somebody that doesn't know how to count.